Once again, we'd like to thank Karen and Jake Abelevitz for sponsoring this morning's Locks and Learn in memory of Jake's parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah Bas Avram, and Karen's brother, Yeshua ben Shimon Dov. The neshamas should continue to have an aliyah. The first source is the Mishnah, the fifth Mishnah in Perkei Avos, which we saw the beginning of which last week. We'll read it in full today and hopefully get a better understanding of the whole thing. Somewhat controversial, but hopefully by the end, somewhat demystified and less controversial. Yossi ben Yochanan, Ish Yerushalayim. So Yossi, the son of Yochanan, a man from Yerushalayim, Omer. So this is what he said, three bullet points. Yehi beischa pasuach lervacha, that your house should be wide open. We'll have to see what that means. Biyu aniyim b'nei beischa, that poor people should be, let's see how the Sansino translates it, let the poor be members of thy household. We'll have to see what exactly that means, because maybe you could read it in a different way. And then finally, va'al tar b'sicha ima isha, you should not talk too much to women. Obviously, the Mishnah is, I assume, pointed at men. I assume women can talk to women as much as they want to, but men should... Maybe not. Okay, I shouldn't make any assumptions. I hear you. But it's probably that case. As we'll continue. Val tar b'sicha ima isha. So b'ishto amru. Here's where we're pretty sure it's referring to men talking to women. This statement was referring to even your wife. You should not be tar b'sicha. You should not have too much conversation with your wife. Kal v'chomer, they say, all the more so, be'eshes chavero, with the wife of your friend. Mikan amru chachamim, it is from here that the sages said, kol zman she'adam mar basicha me'isha, anytime where a man talks too much to a woman, gorem ra'al la'atzmo, he causes bad things for himself, u'botel medivrei Torah, and he will neglect the study of Torah, v'sofo yoresh gehenom, and will inherit Gehenna. Okay, so we're going to unpack that. We're not up to it yet. We'll get there. We'll unload it. We'll figure out what's going on. Let's start from the beginning. Pasuach lirvacha. Your house should be wide open. So what does that mean? Your house should be wide open? Okay, simple explanation. Hachnasas orachim. You should have guests over a lot. I once heard from Rob Sobolovsky from YU that when it's great to invite friends over, and we should always have lots of friends, and it's good to be social people, but when you invite all of your friends over, that's not necessarily hachnasas orachim. Right, that's you having a good time with the people that you enjoy being with. Hachnasas orachim in the classical sense is inviting people who need it, who may make you feel uncomfortable sometimes, who are lonely, who are poor. That's what Hachnasas Orachim is. Just having guests who you like over is great, but that doesn't necessarily, is not your idyllic Hachnasas Orachim. So open door policy, your door should be open wide, Yeh Beischa Pasuach Lervacha. The simple explanation, if you follow my, I gave you a little bit of an outline here, is that the open door policy for whoever needs food, shelter, etc. The Sefer Kisei Rachamim refers to this as being your mind. If you remember last week, we said the Abarbanel understood the last Mishnah that talks about Bayis house as also a reference, a metaphor for your mind. The Kisei Rachamim does the same thing here, is that your mind should be open wide. You shouldn't be small-minded. Basically nothing in this world, he argues, should bother you. If it's an Olam Hazeh related activity, you shouldn't be bothered by it. You shouldn't get so worked up about it. You should have an open mind to things. Again, how far you take that, we could ask the Kisei Rachamim. That's the main idea that he has. And then the final idea in Pasuach Lervacha is from the Pula Sadek L'chaim. You should be open to the needs of those in your household. You should be a Vatran, which means you should pass over things. You shouldn't get angry about lots of different things. And as a consequence, if you're open and if you're nice to all the people in your household, you're going to be also nice to the poor people as well. It's about being, the way I'm interpreting this, a personality, somebody who does things that for other people at their own expense. You're Vatran, you just let things go, you try to do things for other people, you do it for your household, you do it for other people, for the poor, etc. All right, so nothing too crazy as of yet, but we're building up. V'yu aniyim b'nei be'secha. So we want to, as we read, remember one of the methodological points that we wanted to make as we go through all of Pirkei Avos is A, is one Mishnah connected to the previous Mishnah? Sometimes yes, sometimes not. Something we always want to ask ourselves. B, within a Mishnah, are the statements related to each other? Is he telling us three random facts that he liked to say over? Or are these three things building off of each other? So the first two are actually pretty, it's easy to make a read that goes from one to the other. Your house should be wide open. View on Ian, B'nai Be'Secha, and you should have poor people in your house. So house wide open, poor people come in. It's almost like a continuation of sorts. So again, it's almost repetitive. Open door policy, have poor people, according to the simple explanation, have poor people over a lot. Another way of reading this, view on Ian, B'nai Be'Secha, in the second bullet point in number two, is that you should employ poor people in your house. Okay, so if you have, if you have your upstairs and downstairs, you're living upstairs, you have your kitchen and all your maids and everything, should be poor people, right? We know how we all live here. So you should employ, if you're going to employ people in your house, you should employ poor people. I just want to take a moment, if you look, and I said we're going to talk about this last week. I told you this week, we're going to talk about it last week. Flip the page over. I'm giving you this as a, we're obviously not going to read through this whole thing. This is an article from the Jewish Action in December 7th, 2011, The Ethics of Hiring and Firing. So this person, Usher Mayer, was asked the following question. I have a loyal employee whom I'm reluctant to let go, but business is so slow that he is just not earning his keep. Should I let him go or keep him on and endure the loss? Right, so there's somebody who maybe I'm close with, I'm loyal, I've been here for 40 years. Right, this is if you're in the business world nowadays and you're in a big company, there's very few companies who are going to be loyal to you just because you've been there for 20, 30 years. Some yes, some not. But people get let go all the time, and people complain about that. It's faceless, where's my loyalty I showed you? Why are you not showing it back to me? So what does Jewish law have to say about this? So this Rabbi Mayer goes on for a decent chunk of time discussing all of this. And if you we'll briefly read some excerpts here. In the second paragraph, he says, while there are some authorities who rule that an employee has some kind of right or ownership of his job, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, Allah Shalom, right here from Brooklyn, who was my mentor, concludes that, quote, normative halacha rules that the employee at will has no legal claim for tenure, while stipulating that the employee at will is entitled to notice. But again, if you're an employee at will, which means you don't have a contract, there's nothing you can do about that. You could fire them as a boss whenever you want to. You just give them some sort of notice. Employment at will continuing means that an employer is allowed to fire a worker at any time for any reason or even for no reason, but not for an illegal or religiously invalid reason. That is the monetary, the choshen mishpat aspect of the question. So that's in terms of does the boss have any responsibility if the employee is not living up to his job? The boss can fire them. There's not. So, but then there's the second aspect, and that's where I give you the three bullet points here in the middle from his article. Right on top of that, the paragraph starts, however, there is an additional aspect to this question, one which is usually secondary, but which has special importance in today's job market. In this question, as with so many others, the choshen mishpat, so meaning the legal aspect of it, does not exhaust what the Torah has to say about the issue. Alongside the choshen mishpat rule, there is also a yoredeya aspect, the tzedakah aspect. So besides for looking at just an employee-employee relationship, now we also have to broaden the discussion a little bit. What is our value of tzedakah have to say about this this boss worker mentality? So number one bullet point, giving a job to a needy person is considered the fulfillment of the mitzvah of tzedakah. If you have a worker who is not worth his keep, but who may have difficulty finding a decent job elsewhere, there are many reasons to maintain that keeping him on should be very high on the tzedakah priority ladder. So this should be a value that we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about, does this person need money? Number two, giving tzedakah through employment is the highest form of charity. The highest level of charity of all is to steady the hand of the Israelite who falters and give him a gift or a loan or make partnership or offer him work in order to strengthen his hand so that he shouldn't have to ask. And this is a big type of tzedakah. Finally, the third bullet point, your worker should be high on the list of charity recipients. The Torah commands us to give Gemilas Chesed to the poor of your city. So these people who are, if they're in our city, if they're working with us, so they should be on the top of our priority for tzedakah. I should be giving them before I give people who I don't know in a different city, in a different town, etc. They should come first. So putting all these three things together, even if I don't have a legal claim from an employee-employer relationship, what about a tzedakah claim? So Rabbi Meir's argument is that these things should guide our decision. It's not, I can't hold you accountable for it, but these things should guide our decision. He concludes this is a very cost-effective form of charity, while your contribution or sacrifice is only the difference between what the worker is worth and what he gets paid, which is probably only a fraction of his salary. Remember, the worker's doing something, hopefully, meaning if he's completely negligible, if he's costing you money, that might be a different story. But if he's just not as productive as the younger 22-year-old college graduate who's going to be able to do more quicker, etc., then you know, think about how much you're actually saving, and maybe you write that off as a tzedakah. Maybe you write that off as something that you're doing as a charity. So, again, these are not conclusive answers, but at least something to be thinking about in terms of the ethics of this relationship. One second, before I get to your question, is anybody really hot right now? Is that just me? It's hot? It's warm? No? I'm afraid to touch the air conditioner. I don't want people to get... maybe a little bit. Slightly. Slightly. Just slightly. We can always turn it back off. Yeah. So the question was that under what conditions can an employer not fire somebody? So that is a good question. According to what he's excerpting, I actually tried to look this up in more detail, but there's something about, I never took any business classes in my life. I'm not a business-minded person. So when I tried going through it, there was a lot of terms that I just had no exposure to, so it's going to take me a little bit more time to go through all these things. What Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine is saying is that, again, without any contract, in theory, you don't need a reason. There might be other operating principles like tzedakah, like v'achdal reicha kamocha, like not hurting people's feelings that might get involved in the discussion, but as a conclusive legal aspect, it seems to be, again, just from what he's excerpting here, that there's really nothing, as long as it's not, he said here, not for an illegal or religiously invalid reason. What's included in that, we can perhaps do more research and give a share on that at some point. Yeah.
Supposing that there is a situation and it's a family organization and the family doesn't want to keep this person, and if you do keep him on, it will cause Shalom Bayis problems.
Right, so again, so the question was if the keeping the person on has caused Shalom Bayis issues. Again, now we're just adding operating values and principles into our discussion, which makes the thing more complicated. And I don't think there's any right or wrong answer. You need to balance all of these factors. We shouldn't just keep somebody on if they're making mistakes, costing money, creating problems, you know, causing fights. There's no mitzvah to keep people on just because they're poor, right? But assuming other things are equal, and there's some, the way I would look at this is putting everything else aside. Assuming everything else is equal in terms of peace, and if there's, you could hire somebody who's going to, for the same amount of money, do, you know, let's say 2% extra work, right? Or so meaning you're paying this poor person more than he should be getting, because you can hire somebody who's going to be more productive. So there's some loss to you. The main idea is that don't just say, bottom line, I need to make more money. You should be thinking, not that you have to make the decision, but you should be thinking of, can I write this off instead of giving $1,000 to X, Y, or Z charity organization? Maybe this should be my charity. Just look at it within the framework of charity. That's the point I want to make for now. Again, it's a bigger discussion. I do encourage you to read the whole piece here if you want. Let's turn back to the first side. So that was the second bullet point in number two, and employ poor people in your house. And here's where we're going to transition to the next big topic that I want to talk about in terms of things that we need to be thinking about in terms of ethics and stuff like that, is starting in bullet point three. The Medrash Shmuel says, and before we read what he says, just we're going to preface it with the ambiguity within the statement. So what does the statement mean? V'yu aniyim b'nei be'safa. So you can read that as that you should allow poor people in your house, but how else can you read that? that the people in your house should be poor, meaning your family members should be poor. What does that mean? So look at the Medrash Shmuel. Your house should be open to the poor, even if you will have no money left over for your kids, and they will be poor. Right? So this is not a very, at least in our community, type popular idea. Right? We got to invest in every single possible way into our children. And again, I want to be very careful here. I'm not telling anybody what to do, what not to do. I just want to raise the issue because I think it's an important issue. The idea here is that forget about your retirement funds, forget about your kids' retirement funds, forget about your kids' college funds, forget about all of that stuff. If you have right now poor people who you could support, then that's your job. According to this opinion, this isn't everybody's opinion, but according to this reading of this Mishnah, is that stop investing into your kids' future and invest into the poor people who are immediately right in front of you right now. Yeah.
I mean, that seems totally against self-interest.
Correct.
I mean, not only is it against self-interest, it's against your blood.
Yes.
It is. So how does he come up with that?
Okay, I hear you. So I want to hold off on the questions.
No, in terms of forget about self-interest, we're told that when we give stuff, that we should give, like, let's say the 10%,
there's
not to do it to the point that
you impoverish
yourself.
You're
right. So guys, so hold on one second.
Yeah.
We're just starting. Let's go a little bit further, and all of this will hopefully be a little bit clearer. You should be uncomfortable with this idea. You should. I'm not telling everybody to take out your checkbook and start, you know, writing away all of your savings. I'm just giving a counterpoint to what is challenging to our own sources. This is challenging to a lot of our own sources. There are priorities in tzedakah. You shouldn't give away all your money. Right, so there are other priorities here. So hold on, one second.
Why don't you give all your money? Go outside and collect.
Right. one second. We're not done. I'll take questions. We'll have a discussion in a moment. I want to see the sources before we do that. The next source is the Lev Avos. So summing up what he says in a similar fashion, he says you should open up your house wide to the poor and give them generously, but to your own family you should give them little so they are like poor people. And then you'll have more to give others. So again, similar idea. I'm not saying to accept it yet or at all, but similar idea is that view on Ibn Ebe Secha is that the people in your house should be poor, but now go back to that your bias should be open, Lurvacha. You should let everybody else in. You should be generous to all of them. And then when it comes to your own family, give them very little. They're going to be equivalent as poor. This should bother you. This should bother you. Right.
But you have to give them the basics, and then you will have more left over.
Right. Good. So we have to. I don't have the primary source in front of us to go deep down to what he's saying. You could interpret that. However, you do interpret that. So what are the basics? Right. So our, food, water, clothing, shelter. I'll give them to that. And then, do I really need 3 fidget spinners? And all of those type of things. And now, so go. 2 sources, then we'll pause for a discussion for a few minutes. Flip to the backhand of the second sheet. So it should say on the top of Chaim Brisker. So Chaim Brisker, if you remember when Rabbi Brander was here a few weeks ago, at Shal Shudis, he gave a talk on Rav Soloveitchik and how when we think of Rav Soloveitchik, we think of somebody who is a genius, a gaon. And then his point was that Rav Soloveitchik, the way he looks at him as the way that he was Meshamesh, that he served him when he was in YU, was more of a, not that to take away from his gaonis, his genius, but from a perspective of chesed, that Rav Soloveitchik embodied chesed. And if you remember in the beginning, he took as a paradigm to make that same point was from Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather, Rav Chaim Brisker. So Rav Chaim Brisker is known, as a tremendous, tremendous gaon, genius. But as we're going to read in these stories, he was also known as a Rav Chesed. He was an extreme person in terms of the chesed that he did. This is taken from an NCSY printout on Rav Chaim Brisker. I think when they went to his kever, they probably gave this out. Seems that way from the source of the kever of Rav Chaim Brisker on the top. So in the middle of the page, quote from Rav Chaim Brisker about chesed. A person who closes his Gemara because he must perform a chesed, his gemara is still open. A person who opens his gemara to avoid doing chesed, his gemara is still closed. Okay, so that's a direct quote apparently from him. And now in terms of stories about him, Rav Chaim Brisker changed Torah learning all over the world, yet at the same time he was nifter. At the time he was nifter, this was not what he was remembered the most. What everyone remembered was his chesed. On his matzeva was written the title Rav HaChesed. Rav Chaim's house was open to all. In Rav Chaim's living room, beggars would put notices up on the wall. They would sleep on his couches. He would always be careful not to disturb them. Sometimes his wife or children would walk into the bedroom and find that Rav Chaim had invited some poor people to sleep there, and no one in the family had beds. There was a huge fire in the town, and many homes were destroyed. Rav Chaim devoted himself to helping the penniless survivors. Rav Chaim insisted on sleeping in the hallway of the shul. He asked how he could sleep in his bed if there were so many who didn't even have a roof over their heads. Rav Chaim was once having an important meeting with the Beis Din in Brisk. A pauper came into the room, ate Rav Chaim's lunch, and fell asleep on his couch. Rav Chaim warned everyone not to disturb the poor man. Mothers would leave their babies on his doorstep if they were unable to take care of them or if the babies were too sick. Rav Chaim hired women to feed the babies and care for them in his home. The people of the town paid Rav Chaim to be their rav. However, when he got his paycheck, he immediately gave it away to tzedakah. They had to give, look at this, they had to give the money to his wife to ensure that they would have food. Rav Chaim had a rule. Anyone could ask for something and the family would need to give it without a complaint. Once someone asked Revelvel for his pen, this is his son. Revelvel was in the middle of writing some of the Chidushei Torah of Rav Chaim. Revelvel asked him to wait a minute. Rav Chaim got very upset and said, "What is going on here that we don't lend our pens?" Finally, Rav Chaim changed the world of Torah, where all Talmidim of his, because of the Brisker method, the yeshivas that were founded by his Talmidim, and from learning about his chesed. This is extreme altruism. This is extreme chesed. This wouldn't, again, when we read this, part of us is uncomfortable. Part of us says, how can somebody, I wouldn't call it neglect, but prioritize poor people over his own family? How can he do that? Now, one last point, and then we'll pause the discussion. Flip the page one more time. There's an excerpt from an article from The Guardian. There's a book by Larissa McFarquhar, and I heard her speak on a TED Talk. Her book is about this topic. It's about extreme altruists. And it's about how this makes us feel uncomfortable, but there are people out there who go to extremes at the neglect of their own family to help other people. We're not going to read the whole thing, and it's a really longer article. The book, I think, is written in narrative format. I haven't read it. I've just read some excerpts. So she interviews people who are these quote-unquote extreme altruists. She calls them do-gooders. I took out the stories just for the sake of space, and we're not going to read this whole thing. If you go to the bottom of the page where I underlined it, one reason why we feel sort of bad or uncomfortable may be guilt. Nobody likes to be reminded even implicitly of his own selfishness. Another is irritation. Nobody likes to be told even implicitly how he should live his life or be reproached for how he is living it. And nobody likes to be the recipient of charity. More importantly, flip the page one last time, the last page of the booklet. Ambivalence towards do-gooders also arises out of a deep uncertainty. And when she means do-gooders, she means this extreme case. Not somebody who does, and if you read the whole thing, it'll become clear, not somebody who does chesed, somebody who's an extreme altruist. Ambivalence towards do-gooders also arises out of a deep uncertainty about how a person ought to live. Is it good to try to live as moral a life as possible, a saintly life? Or does a life like that lack some crucial human quality? Is it right to care for strangers at the expense of your own people? Next underline, for instance, there is a family and there are strangers. The do-gooder has a family like anyone else. If he does not have children, he has parents. But he holds himself to moral commitments that are so stringent and inflexible that they will at some point conflict with his caring for his family. Then he has to decide what to do. To most people, it is obvious that they owe far more to family than to strangers. Caring for the children of strangers as much as your own, say, would seem not so much different as unnatural, even monstrous. But the do-gooder does not believe his family deserves better than anyone else's. He loves his more, but he knows that other people love their families just as much. And she makes one last point in the next paragraph. There is one circumstance in which the extremity of do-gooders looks normal, and that is war. Right? At war, it's normal, or it's accepted, for people to go and sacrifice themselves, even at the expense of their family. So I'm going to war. I'm putting my life on the line to save the country. That's enough of an excuse. That doesn't make us uncomfortable. That seems to be normal. But when it comes to these other things, that she's not saying what's right or wrong. She's just saying that there's two aspects to this. To most of us, our family should come first. And for people who don't put their family first, we look at that as wrong. And what this sort of counterpoint that I'm trying to make here, and perhaps the Mishnah doesn't even mean this extreme. Perhaps, again, we quoted two sources of explanations of the Mishnah. Not everybody reads the Mishnah this way. And as everybody's pointed out, we have counterindications within the sources that your family does come first. But at least on this one point, in terms of extreme altruists, in terms of when we hear stories of Rav Chaim that seem to be so extreme, to him, everybody was equal.
They were family.
Everybody was family. And maybe even more importantly, these people, maybe he assumed, and maybe you have to know your family. Maybe that's the takeaway. You really have to know your family. He assumed that my family is going to be okay. Maybe he knew. And listen, his family turned out okay. You know, I think, you know, his son and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are all, seem to be living decent lives or productive lives. So it's far be it from us to judge. And maybe he knew his family well enough that they could put up with this. But sometimes, maybe for some people, and if our family's going to be sacrificed for this, we got to take a step back and say, no, we can't have these people over tonight because my kids need the attention. Or no, I can't give my money away to all these poor people because my kids need a college degree, etc. So I'm just bringing this up not with any conclusive answers, just to make us feel a little bit uncomfortable, to see that there is another side to this discussion, and that by definition that side is going to make us feel a little bit weird. I'm going
to...
Yeah.
Is this a point to Goyim as well? His perspective, is that a point to Goyim as well as Jews?
Whose perspective?
Rav Chaim? Yeah. From his perspective, if I see poor people who are in extreme need,
right,
do I have the same obligation of doing an over and above type of testing?
That's a good question. I would have to look into his opinion. Again, within the classic sources in Shulchan Aruch, their priorities. And the Aniyat Yircha, and Jews come first in terms of priorities. And that morally makes sense. You always take care of your own before others. The question is, okay, so but if there's a poor person who's in front of you happens to not be Jewish, that doesn't mean that you don't give them money. It's a matter of priority. You have Mishum Eva. It's a broader discussion. Yeah.
So like Shua said, there's a law of Tzedakah, and there's another one, which is you have to take care of the people in your town.
Right. Again, same point.
From now, that was easy in that town. They everybody knew. They knew that Amona is very poor, so they were taking care of her. Now a professional tzedukah caller, they call him and in advance, they say they collect for somebody else.
Right. So, yes, I hear you. There's an interesting point here about modern tzedakah as well, is that your $100 that's going to go to support a family here to buy cheesecake for Shavuos or whatever, that same $100 can save like 1,000 kids in Africa, right? Or somewhat exaggerated. But so that's another interesting question here. So we do have priorities, and if you do listen, there's the most recent TED Radio Hour, it's a podcast, deals with altruism, and they quote, there's somebody, she's quoted in this, and they quote somebody else who deals with this issue. If you do an accounting of where your money can have the most bang for your buck, there are people who argue that, you know, my $100, the context, even she quotes this, you know, it's like somebody felt bad because she bought ice cream or was some sort of a treat, and she's like, that $4 could have literally saved somebody from getting a shot in Africa to save them from some sort of disease. So we have to think about these things, what our final conclusion is, and how we find the balance, and where we put our money priorities is a broader issue. I just want to raise the issue at least at this point. For those who are West Wing fans, anybody watch West Wing? No? Okay, so there's one episode where I think that brings out the point also, where when you work in the White House, so that affects your relationships as well. So the chief of staff is having a fight with his wife, and she says, "Isn't your family more important?" And he says, "No, right now, this is more important." And he's leading the country. So now, again, it's another extreme example of when do we sacrifice for the greater good? War is okay. You know, leading, is politics okay? Is being a rabbi okay? Is, you know, at what point am I sacrificing for my family? Is having poor people over my house okay? Where do we draw the line? And why is it okay when we think about war, but not okay when we think about giving money to poor people, at least to that extreme extent? I'm not giving answers. I'm just raising the issue. Yeah, Morty.
Crime was not an exception because any person, any robber who's in charge of the community, involved in the community, puts the community ahead of his own family. Whether it has to do with a need, or whether it has to do with the Talmud Torah, then it's left for the wife to take care of all the aspects. So he's not unusual. He's not the exception. He is a person of authority, and in his place, he has to do all these things.
But why do we say that, meaning if we take it from a perspective, your family comes first at all points, then why is that okay? Why do we tell people that this is a good job for you to have? Meaning you may...
Dealing with individuals with one person to deal with it, where someone else might not be able to deal with that situation.
But again, but at the expense of family, if that's the case. Meaning if you're going to assume that my family is going to suffer because I need to take care of the poor people, and I need to take care of the sick people, and I need to take care of all of these people, why we're making a value or a moral judgment here that these people, they're not my family, but they're going to come first. And my family didn't. My kids didn't ask me. I didn't ask them. You know, can I be a rabbi? You know, it's like they're my choices, my decisions to them affect them. I'm here on a Sunday morning instead of talking to my kids. I'm here giving a shiur. So is that fair to my kids?
No.
Right.
We're talking about prioritizing at different times, not 100% of the time having everyone first. And I think kids understand that as long as you give them a certain amount of time every week, that's sufficient.
I hear you. It's a balance, and it's trying to find where that balance is. And the question is that do you have extreme cases where you say forget the balance? And these people are more important than my kids. And these people, I can help 100 poor people have a healthier, happier life, and my kid's going to suffer because of that.
And then your kids may go off the derech and turn out to be...
Right. Okay. So time out. One second. I'm gonna pause it here. We're gonna talk about this afterwards. But we do have the parade. So I told people we're gonna end in time. But I just want to bring it one more point in terms of going off the derech. But I'm going to be careful about this. I am drawing this conclusion, but it's not necessarily a fair conclusion to draw. Go to the second half of your sheet. The second page. Go to page 2. The second actual page. Okay? This is actually a photocopy from last week's shiur. It should say, it should have sources 5, 6, and 7 on it. Right? So this is a recap. If you look at source 5, this was Mishnah 4, and I put in Mishnah 5 there too. We put them both together. Remember that last week's Mishnah had a similar idea. Your house should be open not to poor people, but to the Chachamim. Here it's your house should be open to poor people. We talked about last week the difference in approaches to how we, you know, deal with Hellenism and all that stuff. But the main idea here is your house should be open to everybody else. Right? And what happens to your kids? So now, I'm being clear here. I'm making a jump to other sources, and it might not be a fair jump, but look at sources number 6 and 7, as I hinted to last week. I'll start with number 7. This is the person from the first Mishnah, Yossi ben Yoezer. His son went, quote-unquote, off the derech. Again, I'm purposefully juxtaposing these two to say that maybe there's something here about having your house wide open to everybody else that affected the son. Maybe not. Maybe it's not fair. Maybe the push of Hellenism. Right? The Gemara says that one of the sages was making fun of Menashe, who was the king, evil king, did a lot of Avodah Zarah, and Menashe came to him in a dream and said, "You think you know what it was like to worship Avodah Zarah? Like, if you were there, you would have been running even faster than I would have been running." So we want to be careful when we take things out of context, and I'm not judging anybody here. I'm just saying that there's a juxtaposition here that may be something to learn from, is here you have this message of open your house wide, and his kids weren't from. maybe his kids weren't from because of Hellenism. I'm not saying it was his fault. Maybe it was just the rush and the tide was too big. But it's just, it's too, to me, it's just too much to in this discussion to not mention it. So source number 7 is a little bit involved, and I don't want to go into all the details here, but the basic discussion is that Yossi ben Yoezer, his son married somebody who he shouldn't have married, and Yossi ben Yoezer basically said, I'm not giving you any money, like basically inheritance is getting cut off from you, and the context of the Gemara is actually in Bava Basra, which is, you know, Daf Yomi territory, about when the sages didn't like when you didn't give money to your kids. You should give money to all your kids, except unless your kids are misbehaving. And this is an example of the kid misbehaving, and he didn't give him any money, and the story goes on, and again, it's a little bit involved. We're going to leave it for now, but just to highlight that his kid wasn't exactly the most model citizen. Source number 6 is his nephew. Now, to be fair, again, I don't know how he was involved necessarily with his nephew, but his nephew, as we mentioned last week, was in charge of executing him. Right, so his nephew was in charge of executing the uncle, because the uncle was one of these sages who was detracting from, you know, Hellenistic culture, and the Demetrius commanded them to kill all the sages, and Alcimus here, who is his nephew, was in charge of executing him. The story is interesting, where Yossi ben Yoezer basically makes Alcimus feel really bad for what he's doing, and then Alcimus, or Yakum, as he's called, basically kills himself in various different ways. You can read it on your own if you want. I'm just juxtaposing this to point out to what Helen's point was, is that maybe the message here is there is a cost. And that doesn't mean you don't open your house. Because again, this is the issue. Is there a time period where we are fighting Hellenism and you need to sacrifice, quote unquote, your family life in order to fight that battle? This was a war. It was a war. And in order to win this war of keeping Jewish values going strong, maybe that did take me involve opening my house at the expense of my children and my family. Maybe not. Maybe those are two separate sources that have nothing to do with each other. But even if they do, there's a message here that we shouldn't be judging. We should just realize that there's something going on here. Yeah.
So couldn't you then really interpret the Mishnah of Rabbi Yochanan when he's saying opening your house to the poor? We're talking about the spiritually poor, the non-believers, the agnostic, or those that are...
Does he mean spiritually poor? I don't think... Yeah, I mean, you could read it that way. I didn't see anybody who did. I think Aniyim here. I don't think there's a reason why we need to read it out of context. You have to open your house to poor people. Meaning, if it was saying something that was completely irrelevant and out of the blue, maybe we'd reread it. I think the simple shot is pretty straightforward. Yeah.
This might help out. I heard this in the name of Robertson Press.
Yeah.
From principal of
Asifar. Yeah. She said that Aniyim is another word for that word, and there's enough proofs in the Nevi'im Achronim. Is means that your family should be humble. Translating the word anim is humble, and I think it gives it a whole different perspective and connects really well. Nothing to do with that your family should be monetary poor, but through doing whatever it is, this will create a humility in your house. I thought it was a very interesting way. I think she's quoting the Gra, but I'm not sure.
Right. So just to sort of reflect on that point and be clear and close this out, I will take your question. I'm going to close this section out and leave comment. I'll leave 2 or 3 minutes to do the last one. Just to close off this section, we are within one interpretation of one section of a Mishnah, right? As Rachel's pointing out, you can read this Mishnah in so many other ways. And the simple explanation is probably not that your household should be poor. It's that you should have poor people. Again, it's a continuation. You should have your poor people, have other people in your household. Have poor people in your household. It doesn't mean at the expense of your family necessarily, at the sacrifice of your family. So we're within one interpretation. So we shouldn't get lost and say, you know, there's a crazy idea and this is... I want to say even within this quote-unquote crazy idea, there's some value that this uncomfortability that maybe we feel we should be thinking about, maybe there's something, a lesson here that we should take away. But also just to broaden it, this is just one little teeny drop in a big sea of interpretations. Comment, and then last point in the Mishnah. Yeah.
I was taught that if you give, you get tenfold back. So.
Right. Maybe you do, but I don't know if your kids do. So there's Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter points out, because he gives lectures to rabbis on being a rabbi. And he always points out that Avram had so many people that he influenced, right? The Nefesh that Subach Haran, Avram had all these thousands and thousands and thousands of people who he influenced. Where did they all go? Right? You don't hear a word about them. And Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter's point to rabbis is your family comes first. No matter who you are and how many people you've influenced, those people are great and it's awesome and you should do good work. But it's the Yitzchak Yikarei Lach Zera, right? It's through Yitzchak that you continue. So students are awesome. Students are great, but family's priority. And he lives by that, and he always prioritized the way he tells us. I mean, I wasn't there when he was raising his kids. But the way he tells us is that he prioritized his kids. He was a rabbi of the Jewish Center for 19 years, but his kids were still the priority. Last section of the Mishnah, we'll do it quickly. Yes, I worked this well that we didn't have time to go into this in detail. I'm just kidding. Al tarba sichle me'isha. So don't speak too lengthy to women. So again, I think that this is addressing men to women. The Abarbanel, in terms of continuation, says it is all continuation of the previous points. You're opening your house to poor people. Guess what? There are poor women. So you're going to have women in your house. And he says, be careful. Don't converse too much with the women. Now, I think that part of us, our gut feeling in the modern world, is that we see this and we take a step back and we say, oh, how can you say such a thing? It's really not that crazy of an idea. You see so many times in life where people who don't take this seriously end up getting caught in bad averos. It's not, hopefully we don't know about it too much, but it happens a lot. And people who are too comfortable with other people of the opposite gender run into problems. It happens in the workplace. It happens in communities. It happens all over the place. So it's not the worst advice in the world to keep, to some extent. I'm not saying we have to walk on different sides of the street, but to have some level of distance. Right? What does the Mishnah say? Al tarba. Don't have too much. Who draws that line? What's too much?
You.
Who draws that line? Right. So it's somewhat subjective, and we all have to know within our community, within ourselves, there is a point that we're doing it too much. There's a point maybe we're doing it too little. I don't know. But there is a point where you're doing it too much, and we have to know that balance, that there is a downside here. There's a double downside the Mishnah brings out. Number one, there's a downside in terms of the morality involved that could happen, the sin that could come from that, and we shouldn't brush that and say that's not important or it's not going to happen, because it does happen. And number two is another point is it does, when we talk too much to whether it's men or women, whoever, there's a sacrifice on our Torah knowledge, right? We're talking here Pirkei Avos. How do you become a sage? How do you become somebody who's a scholar? So if you spend all of your time talking, whether it's to women, whether it's to men, whether it's on WhatsApp, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on Facebook, if you spend all your time conversing and being a social animal, which is a good thing, as I mentioned on Shavuos night, we have a corollary of this. In the sixth parak of Pirkei Avos, it says that one of the Kinyanei Torah is miut sicha, is a decrease of talking. That's applicable to anybody, to men, women, doesn't matter. If you want to be Kona Torah, there's a cost to any time you spend talking to people. You are by definition, unless you're talking in Torah, you're by definition not learning Torah. So there's a cost. So don't talk too much to women, right? Right now, again, I can be at home talking to my wife. That would be great. We'd have a good time. Al tarba sicha me'isha, I have to give a shiur, right? So there's a cost. I can give a shiur, I can learn, or I can talk to my family. And it's all about, I think it's similar to the point that we just made, it's all about finding the balance. It's knowing that at some point we should do for other people. We should do for aniyim. We should have poor people in our house. We should have chachamim in our house. There's a cost to our family, so you got to find the balance. You got to know what that is. We should be learning Torah as much as possible, but there's a cost to our family, so you got to talk to our spouses. But you also have to know, when are you talking too much to your spouse? If we have to stay in every single night for 3 hours from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock, instead of going to Davin Marv and go to Night Seder and learn some Torah, we have to converse about our day. At some point, that's too much. At some point, we have to fill our lives with other values and priorities besides for family. We have values of davening, of learning, of doing things, of chesed. So I think the message of the Mishnah, I think for if you put it all together, is that it's all about balance. It's all about balancing priorities and values and finding something that works for us
within the framework of what the Torah tells us is important, and that includes chesed, it includes tzedakah, it includes family, it includes Torah. How do you mix that all in? How do you find that balance? And it's a struggle, and it's up to us to make sure that we're being honest with ourselves and not focusing on one over the other at the expense of anything else. So we're going to close it. I'm going to take questions, but I am going to do it. I think we're going to do it privately because people want to get out and want to bench and go to the parade if you're going. So I'm going to take questions afterwards. Can we have somebody lead us in benching?
Oh, cool. Are you a Kohanim here?